Okay, questions? I'll get the sound of chomping in my beautiful, flawless, edited lecture.
Are we about to have food up here?
I don't see why not.
Questions? Any questions? So you should have that big sheet of paper that has kind of all the answers. So this is all of the kind of standard problems that we can solve with Gauss's law written out. One thing that's maybe a little bit tricky is very commonly the answer is a if r is less than r, then it's something, otherwise it's something else. So notice how those cases are being written. They're being written in terms of the theta function. So remember that the theta function is 1 if the argument is positive, and it's 0 if the argument is negative. So
there. How is that delta thing?
No. So the delta thing is the thing that's always 0 except at one point, but the area under it is 1. The derivative of the theta function is the delta function. So the only thing they're using that theta function for is to write two different cases as one case. But all of the cases are there, nice graphs, all of the answers. And for the problem from 200, once you kind of see the trick, it should be clear, right? In order to calculate the flux, we're not going to do it, right? We're going to calculate the charge inside because it's way easier than calculating the flux. Any questions? Okay, so we spent most of our time last time talking about Gauss's law, which should have been familiar to you from 200. We have this surface integral, which basically, in real cases, is too difficult to calculate. So the only time we can actually calculate it is if we have so much symmetry that the integrand is a constant, so it can come outside of the integration. And then we just basically get the area times the electric field. And under those circumstances, the circumstances on that legal sheet, we can find out what the electric field is pretty easily, and in particular more easily than doing the integrals, right? So what we've been doing long ago is, given a charge density, find the voltage, find the electric field, where we did all of that by integration. So these are our two Maxwell's equations so far. This one is forever. This one's going to be improved a little bit when we have cases that where we have time-dependent electric and magnetic fields. Since the electric field can be written as minus the gradient of something, we have the Laplacian of the voltage is minus the charge density over epsilon naught. And the special case where the charge density is zero is called Laplace's equation. So, I mean, given that we know how to do all of this, you might think that we're done. But typically, it's hard to control where the charges are. They typically move around on you. So typically what we actually can control is the voltage on things. So we got kind of a new problem. Given that somebody told you what the voltage is on the boundary, we want to find what the voltage is, say, inside and outside. And the kind of standard problem we're starting out with, which is example 5 in the big long handout that I handed out to you a while ago, what we're dealing with is the case where we're inside of a gutter that is grounded on three sides, and the voltage is specified on the fourth side. Incidentally, if I had a problem where the voltage was different on all four of these sides, the way I would solve it would by doing this four different times, right? So I could solve this problem, I could solve the problem where it's grounded on these three sides, and the voltage here is specified, I could solve the problem where it's grounded on these three sides, and the voltage there is specified. And then if I just add up those solutions, I'm going to get a solution where the voltage is whatever is specified on all four boundaries. Right? Because if I add up lots of zeros on these boundaries, it's not going to change the voltage on them. Okay, so this is really the start of finding the solution to any specified voltage on any four sides of a long gutter. So we wanted to solve Laplace's equation, and it's tough. Solving partial differential equations is kind of graduate school stuff. So we made what seems like a stupid and not very useful assumption. We assume that the function factored, right? Most functions don't factor. Most functions of x and y, you can't write them as a function of x times a function of y. In particular, the function that we run into all the time, 1 over the distance, right? That's 1 over the square root of x squared plus y squared. That doesn't factor. So almost nothing you can think of actually factors, but life is tough. That's what we're going to assume. And in the end, it'll turn out we'll be able to handle any possible function by superposition. If we add up lots of terms like this, I claim that we can make things that don't factor like that. Okay, so when we plug this into Laplace's equation, we got two separate equations, and this is called separation of variables. The main point is that this was a function just of x, and this was a function of just of y, and the only way something can be simultaneously a function of x and y is if it's not a function of either, right? So this was some constant, which I called m squared, and then it was easy to solve what the y equation is, and it was at least easy for me to write down what the x equation was. And I decided to do that in terms of cosh and sinh, which are just the exponential functions. Cosh and sinh are very similar to sine and cosine. They satisfy lots of the same equations, except with like minus sign differences. Margaret?
Is that potential, right? Not flux?
Yeah. Say again? Yes. Oh, I see. Yes. So flux is also being used the symbol phi for you. But we actually usually won't use the symbol for flux much. So yes. So if you see a phi floating around, if it's not this angle and it's not five or six other things, it'll be the voltage.
Okay.
Process of elimination. Okay. Okay, so what we have left to kind of finish off with where we are is to figure out what values of m are going to be consistent with the boundary conditions. So this function has to be 0 when y is equal to 0. Well, sine does that automatically. Cosine can't do that, so it can't be a cosine function. It also has to be 0 when y is equal to b. So what possible values of m would make it so that so that the sine of m times b is equal to 0? So we're going to require that this thing write. So we want the sine of m times b, and that's giving us the voltage when y equals b. That is supposed to be equal to 0. And of course, that means that this thing here has to be an integer number of pi's. Right? Sine is always 0 at integer multiples of pi. So what we learn from this is m can't be any old thing. It has to be some integer multiple of pi's divided by b. Okay, so our general solution then is going to depend on whatever value I choose for n, and that's going to be sine of n pi over b times y. And then in order to have the function to be 0 when x equals 0, so just as cosine of 0 is 1, cosh of 0 is 1, so the function that's going to work to give us the voltage being 0 when x is equal to 0 is sinh. So what we're going to have then is sinh of m, which is n pi over b, and this is supposed to be a function of x. And just to kind of make the function work a little bit better, I'm going to divide this by a constant, namely sinh of n pi over b times a. And I just did that so that this whole quantity is going to equal 1 when x is equal to a, right? It wasn't in any sense required, but it makes things work a little bit nicer. Okay, so my claim was superposition. So my claim was that any old voltage can be written as a sum of superposition. So I'm going to add up lots of these sort of functions with different expansion coefficients. And the problem now reduces to find these guys. And in particular, find them for the particular case where this voltage is some particular function of y, any particular function of y. Okay, so we have kind of a detour at this point. And what we want to talk about is Fourier's trick. So Fourier, famous dead French physicist, came up with this kind of funny idea, which actually people didn't believe very much at the time. He had a hard time selling this idea. And to kind of get at this idea, let's go back to thinking about linear algebra, go back to thinking about vectors. So if I have a generic vector, I can write it as a sum of our basis vectors, right? So I might have some coefficients ai times some unit vectors ai, right? So in our standard example, our unit vectors were I, j, k, right? And those would be this I being 1, 2, 3. And that was kind of the same thing as then writing this as a1, a2, a3. Well, three dimensions is hardly enough. So let's think about lots of dimensions. So I've got a Google of dimensions. So I've got a whole lot of these indices here, one after another. And instead of kind of thinking them as about them as distinct numbers, kind of think about this a as a function of the index, right? So if I want the 3,225,000 coordinate of this big vector, I would just put in that number and I would get the corresponding value. Okay, so a Google sounds like plenty of dimensions, but it's not enough for me. So let's make it go infinite, like all of the whole numbers. That's not enough for me. I want a real big value of infinity. And I don't know if you know it or not, but the number of real numbers is more than the number of whole numbers, infinitely more, a kind of odd fact. So instead of restricting this index to being a number less than a Google or being any possible number, let me have even more possibilities. Let me have this be a continuous possibility. So now I can talk about the pith coordinate, and I can talk about the eth coordinate, and I can talk about the square root of tooth coordinate, right? So there are a whole lot of coordinates in this vector space. Okay, so let's go back and think about the easier case first. So if I have another vector w, I could write it as a bunch of coordinates. And you all know that the dot product of v and w is just add up these coordinates multiplied together. And if I try and do the same thing with my super enlarged vector space, so what I'm going to have is something that looks like a sum of a of x times b of x. But if I literally add that up for every real number, there are a whole lot of real numbers, so that would be infinite. So I better multiply this by some infinitesimal thing if I'm going to actually get a finite value for it in the end. And of course, dx is a very nice infinitesimal value. So of course, what I'm talking about is our dot product is going to become just integration. Now, the basis vectors that we had, those things were orthogonal, right? So E2 dotted with E3, that was equal to 0, whereas E1 dotted with E1 was equal to 1, or generically, EI dotted with EJ was either 0 or 1, according to whether I equaled J or not. And that's the Kronecker delta. So what are my basis vectors going to look like in this kind of funny system? Well, they're going to have an infinite number of coordinates, just like everything else does. And I'm going to want them to be perpendicular. Let me give a name for this. So when things are perpendicular, we've given you lots of different names, right? So we started with perpendicular, and then we talked about normal, and now we got tired of using those words, so now we're going to use orthogonal. So all those words mean the same thing. They mean perpendicular, except we're kind of thinking this increasingly generally, right? So if I have a Google of dimensions, perpendicular is kind of hard to visualize. But dot product being zero kind of makes perfect sense. The fact that these things are one, I'm going to call normal. So now normal has two meanings, right? Normal can mean orthogonal or perpendicular, or normal can mean that the length of the vector is one. So it's just like R, right? Same word, different meaning, just to make it interesting. Okay, so if I have both of these things, sometimes I call them orthonormal. Okay, so Fourier's trick looks pretty dull, and let's kind of see how it's going to work. So if I have some vector, I'm thinking about it as being a superposition of basis vectors. If I want to figure out what one of these things are, say I want to figure out what A100 is, what I can do is I can take my vector and I can just dot it with E100. Because if I dot this with E100, I mostly get zeros. The only time in this sum that I'm not going to get a zero is when I is equal to 100. And under those circumstances, I get 1. So in fact, A100 is equal to V dot E100. Or of course, more generally, I can figure out what any of these coefficients are, and actually let me use J, by dotting the vector with the jth unit vector. Okay, so orthogonality in general, and this is all, this simple statement is all that Fourier's trick is. That if we want to figure out what one of these expansion coefficients are, all we need to do is to do the corresponding dot product. Okay, so it's not, I think it's not particularly clear how this is going to help. So let's go back to our original problem. So what we said is the voltage at any spot x and y could be written as a sum, but a sum that we don't know these coefficients of, and then times those functions phi n, right, which are sines and sinches in them. In particular, if I evaluate this at the far end, which is x equals a, right, we know that phi at x equals a, that was the specified function of the voltage as a function of y. Right? So I'm claiming that we know this. And what we're trying to find are these things. And remember that I made my fancy function phi n so that if I evaluated it at x equals a, it was just the sine function. Right? I had that 1. So what I'm trying to find then is for any specified, any known function of voltage, I want to write that as a sum of these sine terms. And I want you to think about this as being just like a vector, where these sine terms are the unit vectors, and these things are the corresponding coefficients. And the reason I can say I can do that is these sine functions are orthogonal in the sense that if I integrate from 0 to b of one of these things, say sine of n pi divided by b times y, times another one of these, say m pi divided by by dy, it turns out that this is mostly 0. The only time it's not equal to zero is when n equals m. And under those circumstances, this would be the integral of sine squared, and the average value of sine squared is a half. So when n is equal to m, this is just going to be b over 2. Okay, so these functions are, they're not unit vectors because they don't have length 1, but they are orthogonal, and that's really all we needed to get going for us. Okay, so let's see how this is going to work. So let's say I wanted to find AM, where M is any old number. So M might be the 191st coefficient. If I multiply both sides of this equation by this function, let's see what I'm going to get. So I have V of Y times sine of M pi B times Y. I'm going to integrate this from 0 to B. So that's what I have on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, I've got the sum of AN sine of n pi over b times y times the sine of m pi b times y. So first of all, this isn't, if I know what the function is v of y, this is an integral that I can do, or maybe even more appropriately Mathematica can do. So I just hand this off to Mathematica and have it calculate what that quantity is. So I can calculate that. On the other hand, almost all of these things are zero. So this infinite sum reduces to just one term. The only term that survives is when n is equal to m. And under that circumstance, all I'm going to get is that. So I can calculate any old expansion coefficient that I want by doing, well, by having Mathematica do this integral. So I want m pi over b times y dy, and then divide that all by b over 2.
Why did you say those cancel out?
So I don't make cancel out, I don't like the right word. So
why did you say
they're
zero?
Well, So first of all, it's not the first time I've said they're zero, right? So here's where we said that they're zero. They're only, I claim, if you just do this integral, right, and you've been able to do this integral since your freshman year, it's not super hard to do. If you do this integral, you're going to get zero unless n is equal to m. So that means in this infinite sum, all of these terms are going to be zero, except the one case when n equaled m. In that particular case, that integral is going to be b over 2, so the only surviving term is am b over 2. So I can then calculate what these coefficients are. Right, so if you take a look at example 4 in this handout, I guess it's the very back page. I calculated those terms in line 48. And then I could put together the sum and figure out what the voltage is. So the expansion coefficient was pretty easy. It turned out just to be basically 1 over n. But n had to be odd in order for it to work. And now I have a formula for what the voltage is for any old spot. Now, you may not like that it's an infinite sum, but I guess I have two answers for that, right? So sometimes you can actually sum infinite series. You learned how to do that sometime in calculus. Even when you can't calculate infinite sums, as long as the sum converges, you can just throw away a large piece of it. So instead of actually adding this up all the way to infinity, maybe add up the first 100 terms. Notice that the terms are getting smaller because it's like 1 over n. So if we go far enough, we'll get as accurate as we want, right? Which is basically what convergence says. So I don't know if you see the top diagrams and the rightmost diagrams below, you see plots of what the voltage is. So in the upper left, you can see that the voltage hit, you know, is going to be big when I'm near the right-hand side. If I make a plot of what the voltage is going right down the center of that, you can see it rises up to 1 when we reach the far end. If I cut through at the value of x equals to 1.9, you get this kind of curvy thing on the top. Okay, so I just had Mathematica do that sum for me. I think maybe just the first 20 terms or something like that. And I was nicely able to get the voltages. Okay, so Fourier's trick requires orthogonality of a bunch of functions. So we're going to write a known function as an unknown linear combination of those basis functions, and then we can figure out those unknown expansion coefficients by doing the dot product, doing the integral of the known function and the basis vectors. Yes?
So those A's are your coefficients?
Yeah, so my coefficient was, yes, these A's are the coefficients, and once I find them once, I can apply them all the time, right? So when I want to find the full value of the potential, I just plug them in right there.
And they're dependent on what
they are? So I need to do this integral, and for any old value of m, I'm going to get a different value of this integral. So yeah, they're going to depend on m. That is to say, it depends on which one. So the 100th is going to be different from the 101st. And calculate as have Mathematica calculate as many of them as you want, and then do the corresponding sum to find the overall function. Okay. So sines and cosines turn out to be a set of orthogonal functions. And I think that's going to play a big role in your Fourier analysis class this semester. But they're hardly the only set of functions that are orthogonal like that. And it turns out that we're automatically going to generate a bunch of orthogonal functions anytime we solve Laplace's equation. So kind of what comes next then is to solve Laplace's equation in other sorts of coordinates to get functions that are like sine and cosine that are orthogonal, so that we can expand any old function in them. And although boxes are pretty common, and you remember, I repeat what I said before, if I had the problem that I had specified values of the voltage on all four sides, what I would do is I would solve the problem of it being 0 on those three sides, 0 on those three sides, 0 on those three sides, and what's the final one I've missed? Oh, 0 on those three sides, with specified values here, specified values there, specified values there, specified values there, right? Those are four separate problems that are just like the one we solved. So I could do all of those problems, and then my final phi would just be the sum of them. Right? This one would contribute nothing, this one would contribute nothing, this one would contribute nothing, this one would give me the value that I need at that spot. So just by taking a linear combination of Laplace's of solutions to Laplace's equation, I can generate the solution I want. So we really have solved the general problem of a box that has voltages on all of its sides. But frankly, we're going to be more interested in similar problems where we have spheres, and we're interested in the voltages on all sides. Okay, so far so good. So think of this as unit vectors all over again. So spherical coordinates, right? So, I was sure this was going to have Laplace's equation in spherical coordinates, but it doesn't. Okay, so I'll have to recopy it from my notes. So what Laplace's equation says in spherical coordinates is, and I'll display it in a second after I get it right once. So it's 1 over r squared derivative with respect to r of r squared times the derivative with respect to r of phi plus 1 over r squared sine theta, the derivative with respect to theta of sine theta times the derivative with respect to theta of phi, and then finally 1 over r squared sine squared theta, two derivatives with respect to phi. Okay. So I claim that's the formula for the Laplacian. So while you're recopying that, let's take a second and think about the units. So the units of two derivatives in the denominator should be 1 over length squared times the voltage. And of course, the phis and the thetas don't have any units. So this one has the units of phi over length squared. This one has the units of phi over length squared. This one's a little bit more complicated. The length squared top and bottom are going to cancel out, and we'll get two reciprocal length squareds from those guys. Okay, so Laplacian, and we're interested in Laplace's equation so that the Laplacian is supposed to be zero. And it turns out it's not super harder to solve this in all three coordinates. But there really isn't much to be gained. It just adds extra complications to no point. So what we're going to do is we're going to assume that we have azimuthally symmetric solutions, so that phi doesn't depend on phi. That's nice. So an azimuthally symmetric voltage, and that means that this term is going to be zero. Which is good, right? Because now we only have one phi, right? Having the same symbol be two different things simultaneously is one step too much. Okay, so we have something that's more complicated, obviously, than we had in rectangular coordinates. Even in simple and rectangular coordinates, we were forced to make this stupid assumption that the thing factored. And that's what I'm going to have to assume here, too. I'm going to assume that my voltage is written as a product of a function that just depends on r, that's a capital theta, and a function that just depends on theta. And see how far that gets me. Okay, so when I plug this in here, the only thing that's going to have its derivative taken is going to be this thing that's capital R. Kate, question? What is this? That's a capital theta, as opposed to a lowercase theta.
Okay. Yeah,
no, that's a capital theta. So a capital theta looks just like a theta, except it's bigger. No, it really should be just bigger. And typically, luckily this isn't going to last very long. I'll try and denote it with these kind of extra squiggles there, as opposed to something like that. And if I guess where I'm being, well, it's not going to last very long. You won't have to suffer through this ever again. Okay, so if I plug this in here, the derivatives of r are only going to hit the r term, so that this capital theta piece is going to come screaming out. When I take these derivatives with respect to theta, the capital R piece is going to come screaming out. So what I'm going to get is 0 equals the capital theta, and then I have all of this stuff about r, right? 1 over r squared, the derivative of, like that. And I have also left over and then all of this stuff in terms of theta derivatives. Oops, just sine of theta. And then I have sine of theta prime primed. So the plan is going to be exactly as before. Let's get everything that depends on theta on one side of the equation. Let's get everything that depends on r on the other side of the equation. Notice that if I just multiply through by lowercase r squared, I can get rid of those two guys pretty much immediately. And what I'm going to have then is 0 equals 1 over capital R times all of this stuff. And I'm going to have 1 over capital theta times times stuff that I don't have room for, so I'll write it over here. So I've got 1 over sine theta of capital theta primed. Okay. This is gone.
What was it?
It was not enough room. Okay, so we have the same sort of situation. We have a function that just depends on r. We have a function that just depends on theta. So they have to both be constants. So let me call 1 over capital R squared, R primed, all of that primed. With a little bit of foreknowledge, let me call it L times L plus 1. So evidently, this other thing has to be minus L times L plus 1, right? So we got two differential equations to solve. Let's solve the radial one first. Because I wanted to put all of the r dependence on one side of the equation and all of the theta dependence on the other. So this thing only depends on r, and this thing only depends on theta.
And then I have to put the sides.
Say again?
You said you wanted to put them on different sides.
Yeah, and I didn't bother to do that, right? But it's pretty easy to do.
Okay. So we're just pretending.
Okay. Yeah, so I did it and I erased it. In any case, this thing has to be a constant, and this thing has to be minus that same constant if they're going to add up to 0. Okay, so the r differential equation is going to be r squared, r primed, all of that primed is going to equal L, L plus 1 times r. So this is a second order differential equation with variable coefficients. Who can solve it? Well, when you can't solve it, the usual solution, at least downstairs, is to guess it and show that it works, right? So I actually could go through the steps to solve this in kind of a standard differential equation sort of way. And I don't think it would serve any purpose to do that. But I'll comment that with a change of variables, you can make this into a second order differential equation with constant coefficients. And that's the case that I hope you learned how to solve in DiffEQ last time. So change of variables to get it to a standard form, and that'll work. There's another kind of hint as to why my guess is going to work. And that is, if you kind of figure out how this works in terms of powers, when I take derivatives, I lose a power. So I'm going to lose two powers, but I'm going to bring two powers back. So the power of r that I get after this is the same as the power I had to start with. And that's what this equation says, that when I take derivatives, I get basically back the same thing. Incidentally, cases like that are called eigenequations, which you also learned about in linear algebra long ago. So let me try a guess. So let me guess that r is little r to some power. So of course, then r prime is equal to a times r to the a minus 1. And then I'm supposed to multiply it by r squared, so I get a times r to the a plus 1. And then I'm supposed to take the derivative of that, And that's going to give me A times A plus 1 times R to the A. So you can see it's work. You can see why I chose my constant to be LL plus 1. I got back exactly the same function that I had to start with, multiplied by a constant. And you can see pretty much immediately that the right value of A to use is L. But for a second order differential equation, we expect there to be two solutions. So what is the other value of A that works just as well as that one? So we could actually solve this as a quadratic equation for A, right? So A squared plus A has to equal some constant, plug it into the quadratic equation, and we get two answers for A. But if you think about it, minus L plus 1 also works, right? Because if I add 1 to that, I get minus L, and if I multiply that by minus L plus 1, I still get exactly the same constant. Okay, so a general solution then is going to be some amount of r to the l and another amount of r to the minus l plus 1. Okay, so now we have to solve the theta equation, right? So the theta equation was that okay, so that 1 over sine theta, the derivative with respect to theta of sine theta times the derivative with respect to theta of capital theta, the minus L plus 1 is on the other side, so plus L plus 1 times capital theta has to be equal to 0. So it's another second order differential equation with non-constant coefficients. So let's, maybe eventually we'll spend some time, yes, we will. Sometimes spend some time actually solving this, but not today. But let's take it a little bit further than it is. So I hope you know that I'm really proud of always making the substitution C equals cosine theta. So how can I relate a derivative with respect to theta to a derivative with respect to C? Well, so you know the trick, right? It looks just like division. But they proved it downstairs for you once and for all, so I don't have to prove it again. So what we have then is minus sine theta derivative with respect to C is the same thing as derivatives with respect to theta. Okay, so I'm going to plug that in here, and I'm going to plug that in there to convert all of my derivatives into derivatives with respect to C. I'm going to get two minus signs when I do that, so it's going to look like the minus sign isn't there, but it's in there twice, and so it canceled out. For this derivative with respect to theta, I'm going to get a sign in the numerator, which is going to cancel that one. So I'm going to end up with the derivative with respect to C, sine squared, which is 1 minus cosine squared, derivative with respect to C, all of that of theta, plus LL plus 1, times theta equals 0. This? That's 1 minus c squared, which is just what sine squared is. And one of the signs came from this, and one of the signs came from that. So that's how I got that. So I don't know, to me that equation looks a little bit simpler, and that's maybe a better starting point if we were actually looking for solutions. So it's, again, it's a second order differential equation, so we expect two solutions. but I'm only going to tell you about one. And that solution is going to be called PL of cosine theta. And it's a polynomial. So this is an nth degree polynomial in C. So for example, P0 is equal to 1, P1 is equal to C, and P2 is, I think, 1/2 minus 3/2 C squared. It's either that or the other way. It's either that or the other way around. It is the other way around. Okay. So one question is, two derivatives, there should be two equations. What's the other solution? And there is another solution, but it turns out it has to be infinite. And of course, we can't have infinite voltages, so we can't use those solutions. So there are two solutions. One of them, the other one, you will never see in your life, I bet. But it does exist, and it's infinite, so it never occurs in any physical problem. So these polynomials, no surprise, are going to be orthogonal. That was talked about orthogonality before. So I claim, and this is a little bit more work to prove, but, and I don't think I'll ever bother to prove it, but if you ever care, I'll be happy to prove it for you. So this thing is mostly equal to 0. Otherwise, it's equal to 2 over 2n plus 1. Okay? So there it is, the top of this big handout. So we start in the middle, and now we cycle around to the front. Okay? So if we put our two pieces together, the claim is that any old voltage can be written as a sum of these solutions, right? So I can have sum of the r to the n, and I can have sum of the r to the reciprocal power, and all of these multiplied by pn of cosine theta. So any azimuthal function that satisfies Laplace's equation can be written as such terms. And all I need to do is to figure out what these expansion terms are, and I'll be all set.
So you said any azimuthal equation?
Say again?
You said any azimuthal
solution to Laplace's equation can be written as this sort of sum. So again, azimuthal means that you go around in longitude, you get the same value, and that's pretty common for physical solutions. And I repeat, if we really cared about having things that weren't azimuthally symmetrical, we could make polynomials that have another index, and you'll do that basically in quantum mechanics, where things are a little bit trickier. And Laplace's equation, because that's where we started, right? We're interested in finding voltages in free space where there's no charge density satisfy Laplace's equation. And we've got orthogonality. So we know how to calculate these coefficients often. Okay, so you might follow along. We're now going to look at example one from this handout. So this is I think about as standard as example as you can think about. So I have a sphere, and I have specified what the voltage is on the surface of the sphere. Now you can see I mostly have, instead of talking about voltage as a function of theta, I mostly have voltage as a function of cosine theta. It's not a big deal. And of course, I'm talking about things that are azimuthally symmetric. And at least to start out with, I'm interested in the voltage inside of this sphere. So the first thing to realize is that if there's nothing special happening at the origin, right? It's an empty spot. So there's no way that the voltage could be going to infinity when r is equal to 0. So there absolutely can't be any of these CN terms. The only possibility are these A terms. Incidentally, if we were, and we will soon, be interested in what the voltage is outside of the sphere, exactly the opposite logic would apply. If we are infinitely far from the sphere, the voltage has to go to zero, so we can't have any of these terms, which are all going to go to infinity when R goes to infinity. So inside the sphere, we only have A's. Outside the sphere, we only have C's. And you're going to hear me say that lots of times. That's always, basically always going to happen for these sorts of solutions. But right now, we're only interested on things on the inside. So what we've got then is, in general, the voltage at any old spot inside the sphere, any old function of R and theta inside the sphere has to be equal to the sum of some currently unknown coefficients, an, r to the n, pn of cosine theta. To figure out these coefficients, am, we're going to do Fourier's trick. We're going to multiply both sides of the equation by pm of cosine theta. And then we're going to integrate from minus 1 to 1. Right? Minus 1 is south pole. 1 is north pole, so we're integrating all over the surface of the sphere in actuality. This sum of infinite terms is now going to be a bunch of zeros because these guys are orthogonal. So the only term that's going to survive from the sum is when n happens to equal whatever I chose for m in the starting plot. Okay, so let's write down what we've got. So we've got then that the integral, one other comment. I'm going to do this process the only place I know where the voltage is, which is on the surface of the sphere. On the surface of the sphere, the voltage is given by this specified function. Okay, so what I've got then, I'm going to integrate from minus 1 to 1. I multiplied everything by Pm, where m might be 101. I chose it more or less randomly. Multiplied by the voltage that we know on the surface of that sphere, dc. And when I do that process, this sum breaks down into just one term. Right? All I'm going to get is am r to the m, because I plugged in that r was equal to m. And then from the integral, I'm just going to get this term, right? 2 over 2m plus 1. So evidently, this coefficient, if I can do the integral, I can find out what this coefficient is. It's going to be the integral from minus 1 to 1 of Pm v dc. And then I have r to the m and 2 over 2m plus 1. So I'm going to do that for m equals 0, for m equals 1, for m equals 2, for m equals 3. I'm going to do that until I get tired. And then I can use those coefficients to find out what the potential is inside the sphere. Okay, so kind of a standard example would be to think about the voltage being plus 1 on the top of the sphere and minus 1 below the sphere. I'd better have an insulating gap if I have different voltages. And there at the bottom, I'm doing that integral. So first of all, without doing the without thinking about it, I hope you can see that this is an odd function in terms of reflection. Right? The value on the northern hemisphere is the opposite of the corresponding value on the southern hemisphere. So that means if the boundary has that symmetry, the function on the inside has to have that symmetry too. And that turns out to guarantee that the only terms in the sum are when n is equal to odd. Right? The p's have the same symmetry. When n is even, they are. Let's go look at the examples. Well, so you might remember that P0, that's an even number, is equal to 1. Well, that's perfectly symmetric. and P2 was equal to 3/2 C squared minus 1/2. That's obviously the same whether C is plus 1 or minus 1. So all of the even ends are even in terms of reflection in the equator, which happens at cosine equals 0, whereas our example of an odd P was just C, right? And that's obviously, I hope, obviously an odd function, right? So on the north pole, that would be plus 1, and on the south pole, that would be minus 1. Well, it saves a lot of work. Let me write that out maybe a little bit more clearly, because it's a pretty common way of cutting your work in half. So what we've said is for this particular function, this voltage that we were multiplying by was an odd function of cosine theta.
When did we say that?
Well, when we did this example, right? So, I mean, it doesn't have to be that example. It could be any old thing. Yep, because they're opposite. And I've said that these PMs are either even or odd according to whether M is even or odd. Okay, so let's talk about kind of the general case. If we have an integral, say, from minus L to L of an odd function, dx, well, what does that mean? We're asking for the area under something that looks like that. So this is guaranteed to be 0. On the other hand, the integral from minus 1 of an even function, well, it doesn't have to be non-zero, but it seems more likely to be non-zero, right? So for example, 0, the function 0 is a perfectly good even function. It's not going to be 0. So typically, it's not going to be 0. And of course, the other thing to realize is that an even function times an even function is, of course, even. And an odd function times an odd function is certainly even. Whereas an odd function times an even function is odd. Can you see all of those things? OK, so for the particular integral at hand, we have an odd function. So the only if we choose to have an even value of m, this integral is going to be 0. If we choose m to be odd, then we have odd times odd, which is even. And this integral is probably not going to be 0. So very frequently, there's symmetry in your problem, even or odd. So very quickly, instead of having an infinite number of terms, you have only half of an infinite number of terms. Not nearly as bad. And of course, the plan is that these terms are going to get smaller and smaller and smaller, so we're not actually going to calculate an infinite number of them. We're going to calculate 100 of them and put them into Mathematica and have it go to work. So it turns out, if you look at the bottom, Mathematica really can do the integral for this function for any value of the Legendre polynomial. That is to say, Mathematica knows what a Legendre polynomial is, and it can integrate lots of them. So on the top of the bottom page, there you see me doing that integral. I only have to do it from 0 to 1 because the integrand is now even, right? Because it was the product of two odd things. So I only have to do half of it. Right? So once I have, this thing is going to be twice the integral from 0 to L of the even function dx, right? Because both sides are going to contribute the same. And there's Mathematica's answer in terms of the gamma function. And I bet your calculators have the gamma function on them. My calculator doesn't, but I bet your calculator, I don't know. Maybe I'm not sure 100% about mine either, but I bet yours does. And I don't know, just for recreational purposes, I thought you should know something about the gamma function. And kind of the most important property of the gamma function is the one that is number 10. And what that is saying is that the gamma function of n plus 1 is n factorial. Why they didn't define things so that gamma of n was n factorial is, you know, a mystery. But they didn't. It's the gamma function of n plus 1 that's equal to n factorial. So what the gamma function does is it actually gives us a version of factorial for any real number. So I can talk about what pi factorial is. Pi factorial is equal to gamma of pi plus 1. And you can plug that into your calculator and get a corresponding value. And it turns out that gamma of 1 half is something that you often need. It's the square root of pi. And I've had use for that shifted factorial. I can express that shifted factorial in terms of a ratio of gamma functions. Okay, so in the end, it turns out that these coefficients that I was after are just rational numbers, right? They're not anything that's super complicated, right? 1 minus 1/4, 1/8, etc. Mathematica is making them look pretty complicated, but in fact, they're just pretty normal looking numbers. So in the end, I have Mathematica add up, I guess, the first 20 of those terms, and then I can plot out what the voltage is inside the sphere. So if you take a look at this graph, you can see what that voltage looks like. And it looks pretty much like what you would think. When we get, notice that the plot doesn't actually go to R equals 1. So the actual spot where we have at one point a voltage of plus 1 and minus 1 is off screen. But you can see pretty much the voltage does what you would think, right? It's going to go, as long as we stay away from the boundary, it's going to go pretty smoothly and uniformly from minus 1 on the south pole to plus 1 on the north pole. And of course, once I've got those voltages, I could take the gradient of them to get the electric field, and everything would be copacetic. Okay. So far, so good. So that's one very standard sort of game. So we have two other examples, example 2 and example 3, of how to use these sorts of things in other sorts of circumstances, and 7 minutes to talk about them. Okay, let's try and do example 2. So I commented before that realistically, usually you specify the voltage because the charge density moves around. But can we use this same process if we specify the charge density as opposed to the voltage? So here's an example where instead of having the voltage specified on the surface of the sphere, the charge density is specified on the surface of the sphere. And if you follow this through, in the end, yes, for charge density, for known charge density, I could use this method in addition to the methods we talked about before to figure out what the corresponding voltages are every place. So the key factoid in making this all work is number 17. What's going on in number 17?
A lot.
Well, actually, not so much. So 17 is, I think, the first spot where we actually see the charge density occurring. And I claim that the charge density can be written in terms of the voltage's derivative just inside and just outside the surface of the sphere. So why is that? So first of all, what are these things? So what we've got there is the derivative with respect to r of phi just inside, r is equal to r minus, just inside the sphere. So here's the sphere. What I'm calculating is the derivative just in front of the sphere. And what this is, of course, is it's minus the radial component of the electric field, right? Because you remember that minus the gradient of phi is equal to the electric field. So here we're taking the r derivative, so we're going to get the electric field there. So the other term, I'm taking the derivative with respect to r of phi at just beyond the spot. And that, of course, is going to be minus the radial component of the electric field. So basically what I'm getting by taking those derivatives is the electric field on either side. So let me kind of blow up that little region. So I've got the electric field on this side, let me call that E plus, and I've got the electric field on this side, let me call that E minus. How can I relate those to the charge density at this spot? And the plan is to think about making a little Gaussian pillbox like that. Now I'm going to make this edge exponentially small, right? Because I'm going to take these derivatives right close. So there's basically no surface area there. So my Gaussian integral is of E dot n dA is just going to be the inside surface and the outside surface, right? So what I'm going to get is the electric field in the radial direction just outside times whatever the area is of this top piece. And the outward normal goes this way for that one. So I'm going to have minus the radial component of the electric field just inside times the area. And that is all going to equal the enclosed charge, which is the surface charge density times that area, divided by epsilon naught. So it has to be then that the electric field in the radial direction just outside minus the electric field in the radial direction just inside has to equal the surface charge density divided by epsilon naught. So if you look at, yes? If you look at what's there, this quantity here with the minus sign is the derivative of r with respect to phi inside. And this quantity here with its plus sign is going to be minus the derivative with respect to r of phi just outside. So I want to add those two things together. And notice that that's exactly what I've got in line 17. Okay, so line 17, we've now proven in general, is a great way to relate the voltage, actually the derivative of the voltage inside and outside, to the surface charge density. So I got 2 minutes. Let's take a look at line 15. So we know that in general, the voltage can be written as a superposition of those terms that are like this, right? And we've said it before, if we're inside the sphere, if r is less than r, then I can't have terms like that. So if you look at line 15 in the handout, there's no such term. On the other hand, outside the sphere, where lowercase r is bigger than capital R, I can't have any terms like this because the voltage has to go to zero at infinity. So notice I didn't have any such terms. So in 15, I've got formulas for the voltage inside and outside. They both have unknown coefficients, right? We don't know what the A's are. We don't know what the C's are. The A's are useful when we want the voltage inside. The C's are useful when we want the voltage outside. We want both. And of course, what has to be the case, if we look at line 16, is of course the voltage has to be the same whether I'm just on the outer edge of the inside or on the inner edge of the outside, right? It's the same spot. So the only way those two formulas with 15 will agree when I plug in lowercase r as capital R is if the condition listed in 16 is the case. Okay, so working our way through example 2, we're up now past line 17, and what we're trying to do is to calculate what the voltage is inside and outside a sphere where we've specified the charge density. We could do that with our integral formalism. This is supposedly a better, easier, maybe even quicker way of doing the same thing. Okay, questions?